Shall we turn now in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. The word Genesis means beginning. And we read, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the question arises, how long ago was that? And it is obvious that the Bible does not give us a clear, distinct answer. The word created here is the Hebrew word bara. It is only used three times in the Bible, and it is that capacity of creating something out of nothing. It is a capacity that is exclusively God. There are two other words that we'll be coming across, asa and yatzer, that are translated made or formed. And they are the Hebrew words for the assembling of existing materials. So we say someone created a new television. No, he didn't. He may have assembled existing parts, but he didn't say television B and suddenly there was a television there. Creating out of non-existing materials. Only God has that power in the Hebrew word bara. Interesting that in this account of creation, we find the bara used just here. At the very beginning, and then we find in God made and God formed, that is using the existing materials and assembling things together out of the materials that then existed once he had created the heavens and the earth. Now, the book of Genesis goes back to the beginning of creation. The material universe, the beginning of time. But time is related always to the material. There is a dimension in which time does not exist, that is the eternal. And we cannot really think, our minds aren't programmed to think in that dimension. To us, everything has a start and a finish, a beginning and an end. But we cannot really conceive of timelessness, of the eternal. Just how long ago in our time was the creation of the universe? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You see, before the heavens and the earth were created, God thought about you. Christ was crucified before the foundations of the earth. Before God ever created a material universe, he thought about you, he loved you, and he planned for your redemption. Hard to really conceive, but such is the stated case of the scriptures. But then God created the material universe. There are several assumptions or ways of looking at this. There are those scientists today who are taking a very literal kind of a look at this and saying it was only around 6 to 10,000 years ago that the physical universe was created. And they are beginning to offer a lot of evidence to support their claim. Dr. Henry Morris has written several books on cosmology and the beginnings and the creation of the earth, and I respect highly this man's opinions and views. He is a scholarly man and a dedicated Christian. There has come a system of thought that has definitely dominated our educational system and has so prevailed that it is hard for us to divorce ourselves from the pseudoscience of evolution. It is not a true science. It doesn't deal with empirical facts. It deals only with theories and hypotheses that change day by day with the changing evidence. You remember that they were telling us that when the lunar module landed on the moon, it would probably be swallowed up in the moon dust. For they hypothesized that the moon must be at least, 6 billion years old. And having no atmosphere, those meteorites that come into the moon and explode are turned into dust. And so there were those that were predicting that the moon dust would be somewhere between 17 and 35 feet deep. And so a lot of expense was given to the preparing of the lunar landing module to counteract this tremendous dust cloud that they expected to arise and perhaps swallow the lunar lander, and it was one of the real concerns of the scientist. Now, you saw on television as they walked on the moon, and the moon dust was less than an inch thick. Now, these men who had hypothesized this ancient moon somehow were very silent about the lack of the 35-foot covering of dust over the moon. There are a lot of other interesting evidences that you can use to show that the Earth is probably much younger than the necessary 12 billion years for the evolution of the single cell into the complex human form. And the only reason why we have postulated an extremely old Earth and universe is to accommodate a theory that has very little actual proof, or no actual proof, but just a lot of hypotheses that are built upon hypotheses. And yet it is so accepted by the intellectual community that no one dares to say that perhaps the evolutionary concepts are wrong. It reminds me of the story of the king who wanted a new suit, and the tailors came in and said, "We are going to sew you the most beautiful suit in the world, and we are going to use an invisible thread to make the material. But only the very intelligent will be able to see it. Those who are not intelligent won't see the suit. Only the very brilliant and intelligent people will see it." And so they measured the king, and they began to fit the king with this new suit, and they tried on his new invisible coat, and they said to all of his counselors, "How do you like that coat? Isn't it beautiful?" And none of them wanted to appear ignorant. They all wanted to appear very wise to the king, and so they all commented on how wonderful the coat looks. "My, what a perfect fit," and they went on until finally the king, dressed in his new suit, went out among his subjects wearing his new suit. But alas, some poor fool standing on the corner looked and said, "The king is naked." Same concept. They have got the idea that if you're extremely wise and intelligent, you'll believe the evolutionary theory. Only a fool could believe that God created man. And they've got the whole academic, not the whole, thank God there are enough wise men among the scientists that they are saying the king is naked. And they're admitting that there is not any real proofs or evidences offered that can prove the evolutionary theory. There is a book called Earth in Upheaval that absolutely destroys the idea of uniformitarianism. Immanuel Velikovsky, Earth in Upheaval. You might get that book. It just shatters the theory of uniformitarianism, which is the basic theory upon which evolution is built. More and more scientists are coming out, exposing a lot of the problems of embracing the evolutionary theory, and that's the only reason why we would want to create a Earth of several billions of years or a universe of several billions of years to accommodate a theory. An interesting paper was done by Dr. Barnes at University of Texas, East Texas in El Paso, on the electromagnetic fields that surround the Earth. He's probably done more study on the electromagnetic fields than any other scientist living today. Dr. Barnes, in this interesting paper, points out that over 135 years ago, about 142 years ago now, a Dutch scientist measured the level of the electromagnetic field around the Earth. And in every subsequent year, there have been measurements of this electromagnetic field around the Earth, and we find that the field is gradually decaying at a very constant rate, a predictable rate. And in the 140 years of measurements, there has not been one variance in the rate of decay of the electromagnetic field. Now, this electromagnetic field around the Earth does have a protective kind of aspect to it, in that it does cause many of the cosmic rays to be repelled or to bounce away without hitting the Earth. We do realize that much of the mutation and age processes and all are caused by cosmic rays, those rays, the gamma rays and the various neutrinos and so forth that are bombarding our Earth and going through our bodies and causing a mutation of our cells and bringing on the aging processes. We realize that if we put milk, shield milk from the cosmic rays, that milk will keep fresh for months without refrigeration. But there is that deterioration that takes place, and we will be getting in a little bit to the moisture blanket that God used to have around the Earth that also was a shield against much of the cosmic rays. We realize that the ozone blanket also shields us from cosmic radiation, especially the ultraviolet from the sun. And with the deterioration of the ozone blanket as the result of our use of fluorocarbons and so forth in aerosol cans, the SSTs and the detonating of atomic missiles in our atmosphere, that now we are receiving a heavier bombardment of the ultraviolet rays, causing exposure to the sun to have a greater detriment, and skin cancers are an extremely common thing now. If a person gets exposed to the sun too much, and the constant warnings to watch your exposure to the sun, it can be very damaging to you. It used to be a very helpful thing till we started destroying the ozone blanket, but now it's become a very damaging thing, a exposure too much to the sun, and we're being warned about it constantly, especially by the skin specialists who deal with the maladies that developed from overexposure to the ultraviolet rays. In his paper on the electromagnetic fields, in pointing out the decay of the magnetic force in these electromagnetic fields, in postulating, if it is decayed in the last 140 years at a constant rate, then turning it around and assuming that this has been a constant, which it has been for 140 years, turning it around and figuring how strong was the electromagnetic force, say, 25,000 years ago. The electromagnetic force around the earth, if this has been a constant decay for 25,000 years, and we turn it backwards, we find that 25,000 years ago, the electromagnetic force would have been so strong that it would have heated up the surface of the earth to about 240 degrees, so there could be no moisture on it. It would have all evaporated into the atmosphere. As far back as 100,000 years, if this decay has been the same over a 100,000 year period, the magnetic force would have been so strong, the heat would have been so great, the earth would have been in a molten state. So feeding that to the evolutionists who needed several billions of years, they talk about how that it dies down and then every, 10,000 years or so, it's recharged. Oh, very scientific solution. Who recharges it? And with what kind of a system do they recharge it? So there, whenever the gaps appear, for instance, I should have brought it out tonight. Romaine, are you around? Want to go in my office and get that footprint in my office? I have, and bring the shoe too. I have the cast of a footprint taken from the Paluxy River in Texas. This footprint was found alongside of the footprints of a dinosaur, fossilized in the Paluxy River. And they have found hundreds of them intermixed with the dinosaur tracks, crossing the dinosaur tracks, and even imprinted within the dinosaur tracks. Now, this is, of course, a tremendous difficulty for the evolutionist, who have the dinosaurs living 100 million years ago and man coming on the scene about 3 million years ago. But here in the Paluxy River is proof that they at one time coexisted upon the earth. Now this is a shoe for a real man. It's a size 18. I don't wear it. But here is the cast of one of the footprints in the Paluxy River. Now, interestingly enough, this shoe will fit completely in the... This guy couldn't have worn this shoe. See, the toe is still out the end here. Now, does that look like a human footprint to you? The scientists that were brought down to examine it, who minds are set with the presupposition that evolution is true, could not define this as a human footprint. Because it was found in the footprint of a dinosaur. So it led this brilliant scientist to conclude, well, it certainly appears like a human footprint. It looks like it is a possibility, but we know it can't be. Now that's real science. I don't know. The king is naked. I'm not a brilliant scientist, but I know a footprint when I see one. So there are those scholars today, and their number is growing day by day, who are declaring that the theory of evolution can no longer adequately explain the existence of man or the universe. We have had Dr. Wilder Smith here on several occasions. I highly recommend his books. He writes in a very clever style. And in pointing out really the truth of what Genesis declares, everything after its kind, and that there can be no real transformation within a closed system or evolutionary process within a closed system, he points out how important that is to our whole lifestyle. For if you could have dramatic changes within a closed system, it would be interesting every time you opened a can of peaches to find out what you had inside. The changes that had taken place, you know, within the closed system. In the beginning, God created, and here it declares that the universe was a creation of God. One further little note, and with that we'll quit hammering. Darwin, of course, postulated that man evolved through a long chain of processes which are known as fortuitous concurrences of accidental circumstances. You see, they snow you with the big words. Like, man, those are huge words, you know. Postulated that, you know, we evolved from the simple cell. And, you know, when I was a kid, that's what they were teaching in the classes in science in school. Of the simple cell, that's before we developed the electron microscopes. That's before we discovered the DNA protein molecules. And that's before a lot of the later discoveries and the discoveries of the chromosomes and the genes and so forth. And suddenly we find out, hey, it is not a simple cell. It's probably the most complex thing in the whole universe, with all of the code within it for what is to be formed from it, all encoded, this one little cell, and all of the codes that are within it. Far from simple. But the interesting thing, the cell within a frog is far more complex from the man. And so if we're in a upwards movement, then, you know, your next move will be probably towards the frog, because its cell is really more complex than that of a human. But in a science symposium called in Europe, in which the greatest scientists of the United States and Russia and Europe were brought together for the purpose of determining the possibility of extraterrestrial communication from outer space, intelligent beings out there somewhere trying to communicate intelligently with us here on the planet Earth. The symposium was reported in a book edited by Carl Sagan, one of the leading exponents of the evolutionary theory. And it was published by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology back in 1975, and the book is entitled Extraterrestrial Communication, and it is a symposium, the title of the book. The first paper that was offered to the scientists was offered by a group of scientists from the United States. Understanding what we do now about the complex cell and the complexity of the cell and the DNA molecule and all, they put together all of the chance factors of bringing the cells together in a random choice kind of a selection to determine what is the chance factor for the first protein molecule to develop by this fortuitous concurrences of accidental circumstances. And it turns out that it would take 10 to the 28th power fortuitous concurrences of accidental circumstances to create your first cell. Well, that's a pretty big number. Because if you take and assume that they are correct in the 12 billion year life of the universe, there's only been 10 to the 17th power seconds in the 10 billion years. So you are assuming then that there are trillions of these chance factors going on all over the universe at the same time. In fact, you have only 10 to the 25th power grains of dust upon the entire earth. So they would have to be interacting billions of times every second over the 10 billion years. And still you don't have enough time for them to come together in an accidental form to form the first protein molecule. So the only solution, of course, is, well, the whole thing probably is 25 billion years old. You know, anything can happen given enough time, is the theory. In the beginning, God created. You know, that takes less faith for me than to swallow the evolutionary theory. I have no problem with an intelligent, powerful God, eternal, calling into existence a universe. For he is an infinite God, therefore he can do anything. Now, the universe that he would call into existence would demonstrate his intelligence through that form of life that he would put upon the earth. There would be a demonstration of his intelligence. And you can take the creation model and study the geological column, which does not exist. It's only a hypothesis. There's nowhere in the earth you can go and dig down the side of a cliff and say, now here's the geological column from each period progressing upwards. Sometimes whole layers of older formations are on top of younger formations for miles. Oh, then they have the theory of the, you know, the crust crossing over the top and overlaying crust, and you know, everything is happening in 10 billion years, you know. But as I say, there's a lot of good books to read on that. You can read just as well as I can. And don't read just one side. Read some of Dr. Gish's books and Dr. Morris's books and John Whitehead's and some of these fellows who have done a lot of research on the creation theory. And you see, those who oppose Dr. Morris never oppose him on scientific grounds. I've never heard him bettered on a scientific ground. They only oppose him with ridicule. You know, how can he call himself a scientist? You know, because he doesn't believe that the king has a beautiful coat on. Now, just when God did create the heavens and the earth, we do not know. I do not believe that the Bible of necessity would cause us to believe that it is just 10,000 years old. It would indicate that perhaps there is a gap of time between verse 1 and verse 2 in Genesis. For in verse 2 we read, "The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." Now, the earth being without form and void does not sound to me like God's creation. For as we read in verse 10, or verse 4, God saw the light that it was good. Verse 10, God saw that it was good. Verse 12, God saw that it was good. Verse 17, God saw that it was good. Also verse 21 and verse 25. So the creation of God was good. Sometime, and perhaps before God laid the foundations of the earth, or maybe after he laid the foundations of the original earth, God created other beings that are not human. God created divine beings that we call angels. They are in a different dimension than we. They also were created in part in God's image and after the likeness of God, for they were created self-determinate beings. For God desired to receive and to have fellowship with them, as well as he desires to receive and have fellowship with us. And thus the creating of the angels as self-determinate beings. And one of the angels decided to rebel against the authority of God and to advance his self into the God state, to be worshipped as God. His name is known as Satan or Lucifer, the dragon, the devil. But he at one time was one of the anointed cherubs. He was at one time in a position of great honor. Ezekiel tells us that he was perfect in beauty and perfect in wisdom and perfect in all of his ways until the day that he rebelled. Iniquity was found in him. And at that point he was cast out from his position. Isaiah tells us that he said, "I will exalt my throne above the other angels. I will sit in the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend to the Most High, and I will be like the Most High." His willing against the authority and government of God. And the book of Revelation would indicate that perhaps as many as a third of the angels followed him in his rebellion. And so they make up a second kingdom within the universe, the kingdom of death and darkness, that is now opposed to the kingdom of God, the kingdom of light and life, and God has allowed the second kingdom to exist. So when was Satan created and the angels? Where was the Eden that he inhabited? "For thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone was your covering." When did this take place? When did Satan fall? No doubt sometime in the prehistoric periods before God created man, because Satan appeared to man very early in the fallen form in the garden. Now, one of the difficulties that I have with Dr. Morris's literal 10,000-year-old Earth or less is that, or universe, I feel that it doesn't give room for the creation of the angels in the fall of Satan. So I believe that there probably is a gap of time that does not explain the fossil records. I believe that the fossil records are better explained by the flood. And if you'll read Earth in Upheaval by Emmanuel Velikovsky, you'll find some extremely fascinating facts that are not brought out in your textbooks concerning the discoveries of the bones of animals in caves, crushed, and animals which are natural enemies altogether, crushed and broken in caves as though by some violent force. And he gives just record after record of these things all over the world, speaking really of a violent upheaval, which better is described by the great flood of Noah and the fossil record. Where do you find fossils being formed in tremendous amounts today? Not on the ocean floor, for actually they deteriorate and dissolve without being fossilized. Fossils were formed by some convulsion of nature where there was the death of the animal or the breaking off of the plant, and then the covering with sediment and the tremendous pressure causing it to be fossilized. Oh, you can find you can create fossilized forms. I have a friend who was a scientist who was going to one of the national conventions of the scientists, and he decided to have some fun, and he took and created a cast of a skull that did not look human. It looked more like a humanoid. It looked like the missing link, actually, and he deliberately designed it to look like that, and he took it to the silicate springs up near Bakersfield, where if you will put a bone or something in that silicate springs, it'll fossilize it in 6 hours. He left it in 24 hours to do a good job. And went back with a story of digging in a cave and coming across with this fossil. And it was interesting how that the brilliant men were dating the thing as much as 90,000 years old and all, you know, and this was surely the missing link, and he was the talk of the convention that year until he confessed his hoax and was, well, he came very nearly being dismissed from the Academy of Scientists. You know, when I went through the Oregon caves, they explained to me how many millions of years it takes for those stalactites and stalagmites to form, and how they are able to date the Oregon caves by the length of the stalactites, you know, and it was marvelous because they were able to take the mineralization and so forth, the buildup, and then the length of it, and they can tell you exactly how long that thing's been forming, millions of years. And that was a very common age-dating factor until they found under the Washington Monument stalactites that were 5 feet long. And that thing was built in 1924. Pop goes the weasel, the king is naked. If Genesis 1 deals with the original creation of the material universe, it does not really deal with the actual beginning. The Gospel of John goes back before this. Before the universe existed, God existed. In the beginning, and John goes way back now. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's going back, even before the material universe. All things were made by Him. Now he comes to Genesis 1, the creation of God. But how long did God exist? He's existed from eternity. Again, we have, our minds cannot deal with a timelessness. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And so we see a universe. An earth actually in the universe. Not necessarily the universe itself. But the earth without form and void. Darkness over the earth. The Spirit of God. And interestingly enough, here in verse 2, we find the very first mention of the Spirit of God. Then God said, and the word God is Elohim. In the beginning, God, Elohim. If you know anything about Hebrew language, you know that the I am is plural. God singular is El, E-L. God, and the Hebrew has a dual text. The dual is Elah, or Elah. God's plural is Elohim. In the beginning, God created. And even there we have the indication of the Trinity or the triunity of God. Father, Son, and Spirit. And the Spirit shows up right in verse 2. Actually, the Son is there in verse 1 because all things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. So when you read, He created the heavens and the earth, you have the Son involved. He, according to John, is the creator, the agent of creation. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. Now, interesting, God divided the light from the darkness. And I'm sure that it was just meant that there is a division between light and darkness. But the idea of God dividing the light is interesting because we know that light is divided on the spectrum. And we can divide light with a spectroscope. And there is light even in the darkness, but it is dark light, the infrared. You get down to that dimension where it's no longer visible to the eye, but it still exists, but it is dark to us. And yet there is the infrared. And below, light that is not seen. So God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, so the evening and the morning were the first day. Now, this creates a problem in the minds of many people, in that we do not read of God creating the sun and the moon. God made two great lights, verse 16, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. Notice, though, God made, that is, assembled, asa, not bara. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth itself. But the earth was shrouded in darkness, covered with darkness. Perhaps shrouded by dark clouds. Perhaps in a dark nebulae. Many possibilities. And it began to emerge, and there was light, but still covered by darkness. Only the first rays of light now penetrating through the cloud covering. so that it was possible to know that it was evening and it was morning. For how could you have the evening and the morning aspect unless the earth was rotating on its axis and you have, of course, the sun out there in its position? But then the light holders and the light of the sun allowed then to come through to the earth on the fourth day of creation. Verse 6, then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, raquia, limitless expanse. So the evening and the morning were the second day. So the atmosphere, and the Bible does refer to three heavens. The first heaven is that atmosphere around the earth that surrounds the earth. The atmosphere going up into the stratosphere. The second heavens is the stellar heavens. The universe itself, and God placed the stars and all in the heavens. The third heaven is the dwelling place of God, wherever that may be, and I do not believe that it is way out in the Andromeda galaxy. I believe that the third heaven is very close to the earth, but in a whole different structure, molecular structure, and also that I believe that, as the scientists do postulate, the possibility of two Earths coexisting at the same time in the same place, both of them passing through each other, each of them oblivious to the other's existence because they are made up in a different molecular structure. The interesting thing about the material structure as we know it is that there is much more space than solid matter in material things. If you had a molecule of hydrogen and you blew up the nucleus of the hydrogen, the proton, to the size of a basketball, the little electron that is revolving around it would be 3,000 miles away. There's that much space in the hydrogen atom. Actually, if you would reduce all of the atoms in your body to just the solid materials, if there were no space in the atoms that make up your body, if it, all of the electrons would collapse into the protons, you'd need a microscope to see yourself. There's not, you're just a bunch of blown up. Expanded molecules. And yet you'd weigh the same. That little microscopic speck of dust would weigh whatever you weigh. It's a matter of density. We do know that there are some stars out there in space that have a much greater density than does the sun or our own planets in the solar system. In the Dog Star, which is a double star, which we have discovered, the smaller one is called the Pup. It is estimated that the density of the Dog Star is so great that a square inch of the Dog Star would weigh 1,750 pounds. The atoms are more tightly compacted. Now imagine going down the path and seeing a meteorite that happened to fall from the Dog Star, and you decide to kick the thing off the path. Just a little thing. You tried to pick it up, 1,750 pounds. So, in the molecular structure, it is possible that heaven is much closer to the earth, and I do believe that it is. I believe that there are two worlds coexisting, the spirit world, the material world, passing through each other. Only, I believe, they're aware of our existence, though we, for the most part, aren't aware of theirs. And I think that the scripture teaches this. Now, in the creating of this firmament, the atmosphere, God placed originally a tremendous volume of water in the atmosphere, suspended it. Now, we do know that water can be suspended in the atmosphere. Tremendous volumes of water. And sometimes when the clouds come over and are cooled too quickly, that volume of water falls on a particular area and we have tremendous floods. The amount of water that can be suspended. And of course, God's whole system is so marvelous. The rain cycle or the water cycles. Think of the engineering processes that God figured out in creating, first of all, the gases that make the water, the hydrogen oxygen, H2O. Both of them lighter gases than our atmosphere itself. Of course, the atmosphere is 79 parts of nitrogen to 20 parts of oxygen and 1% of freon and neon and some other of the gases. But basically, nitrogen, oxygen, atmosphere. Oxygen and hydrogen in their pure forms are heavier, are lighter than just the atmosphere itself. And so as the sun hits the oceans, water evaporates into the gases. Hydrogen, oxygen carried them by clouds and by the winds, brought down from the north or across the Pacific. And then as they move inland, they begin to cool and they begin to drop their water on the land. And it creates the snow in the mountains and is preserved or kept in store. In the summer season, it begins to melt so that the streams run during the summer season, bringing us the fresh water as they flow back into the sea, only to be carried again, purified, and distilled by being transferred into their gases and carried aloft and back again. And the whole cycle is just a marvel of engineering that God designed and figured out by creating the balance of the earth and the sea to 2/3 water and 1/3 earth. And any other balance, you'd be living in a marshland if there were more water and less land. And if it were the other way, then more land and less water surface, then you'd be living in a vast arid desert. Land would be inhabitable. So the whole balance, the whole design, just marvelous, fortuitous concurrences of accidental circumstances that made the whole thing possible. Now, this original water canopy filtered out many of the cosmic rays so that the body being marvelously constructed and made by God, recreating itself over and over. In the beginning, while there was this protective blanket, life, physical powers and abilities would continue for almost 1,000 years without being abated. Because there were the mutations that were created by the bombardment of the cosmic rays. They were being shielded by the water canopy around the earth. So we have found in fossils asparagus ferns 50 feet tall. Ideal growing situations because you've got this moisture blanket covering the earth, the whole earth, like Hawaii. You didn't have your polar regions, the vast ice waste area of the North and the South Pole, but they were also tropical beautiful tropical areas, as is shown by the charcoal deposits at the South Pole, some 200 feet under ice, as is demonstrated by the mammoths found encased in ice in the areas of Siberia, with tropic vegetation in their digestive tracts. So the earth at one time was a much more hospitable place. Without the vast areas of ice and cold in the North and South Poles, you would not have the violent storms. You would have only a gentle movement of air. You wouldn't have hurricanes. You wouldn't have tornadoes. The air movement would be much more gentle because you wouldn't have the large masses of cold air falling into the vacuum created by the rising of the hot air. You'd have had a beautiful hothouse kind of a effect around the earth, and the plants not being destroyed as far as their molecular structure by the bombardment. Man not being destroyed by the bombardment, being shielded and protected, would live to a productive 900 years plus. And so it explains the longevity of the antediluvians. How that Adam and his descendants up until the time of Noah lived an average of 900 years old, still bearing children. Imagine 900-year-old woman saying, well, I'm pregnant again. This is the 185th time, you know. God divided the waters, atmosphere. And so there were the stellar oceans as well as those upon the earth. Evening and morning, second day, then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. Now, it would appear here that originally the land surfaces were all together. It is possible that the theory that is gaining great popularity of the continental shift actually is a correct theory, that there did come a time when there was a great continental shift, a drift of the continents, if you please. And that seems to be a theory that is embraced by many of the scientists today, that the continents were all at one time joined. It would indicate in the book of Genesis, and we'll get there as we go through, that it was in the days of Peleg that the earth was divided, that is the time that this great continental, not drift, but splitting took place. God called the dry land earth, the gathering together of the waters he called seas, plural, interestingly enough. How did Moses know when only he had to deal with the Mediterranean? And that was known to them as the Great Sea, and they thought that was it. They thought that it was just one. But we know that there are seas. We talk about the seven seas, major seas. Plural. God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herb that yields seed and the fruit tree that yields seed according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit whose seed is in itself according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. So the bringing forth of the botanical kingdom. Now, the interesting thing about it is that they bear seeds according to their kind. Now, if there were any chance to prove the evolutionary theory, you could prove it every year when the farmers plant billions of wheat seeds. And the day one of those grains of wheat turns into an apricot tree, you've got a classic demonstration of a transmutation. Now, mutations, sure, they take place all the time. You know, you can have a royal apricot, or you can have all different kinds of apricots. You can have a delicious apple, a golden delicious apple, a pippin apple. And I'm getting hungry for apple pie. And, you know, I mean, you can have Roman beauty or pippins or all kinds of apples, but they're all apples. The minute you plant an apple seed and you have an orange tree, then you've got a demonstration of evolution, because now you have a transmutation. You've crossed a species from one to another. A lot of changes within a species. You have all kinds of dogs, all kinds of cats. But when you put your two Samoyeds out in the yard to breed, and they produce a Persian kitty, you've got transmutation and valid proof for the evolutionary theory. So, interestingly, God, of course, commanded them to fill the earth. We'll get that in the next chapter. And I'm always amazed at again, the engineering and the genius by which God created the seeds and created them to propagate. The different ways by which a seed propagates itself. They have what we call exploding seeds. As the pod dries, it explodes, and as it explodes, opens with a pop, it shoots the seeds on out. The pine tree they call them propeller seeds. Has a little ingenious fin on it. And when the pine cone opens up and the seed drops out, this little fin starts it spinning, sort of rotating, and as it spins, it begins to move out from under the pine tree so that it can fall and be planted outside of the shade of the pine tree where it can grow up on its own. So this little neat propeller seed that spins and brings it out away from the pine tree. Then you have umbrella seeds and this little dandelion that you're problemed with in your grass. As it turns to its seed, it forms a puffy little umbrella on it that when the wind comes, it picks it up and carries it on off, and it falls someplace and then propagates itself wherever it falls. Or, of course, it has many seeds, and a lot of times parts of it will fall as it's floating through the air. When we were kids, we used to take those things and blow on them, just disintegrate them, you know, but we were just helping it propagate itself. How many times have you been out hiking? And when you get home, you pick all of the little hitchhikers off of your socks. The foxtails and those other seeds that put little hooks on themselves to catch a ride when you brush by it. And then when you get home and you start pulling all of those things out of your socks and throwing them down, you're just help propagating that noxious weed. There are other seeds that have a little fast-drying glue. And as you walk by, it'll glue itself to you. And when the glue dries, it'll fall off, and you've given it a ride and propagated it without even knowing it. Then other seeds surround themselves with luscious-tasting meat. And you take and you eat it, and then you blow the seeds out of your watermelon, and you're propagating that watermelon all over. The blackberries. The bears eat them. And then in their elimination processes, propagate the blackberry seeds all over the country. Ingenious ways by which God designed that they should propagate themselves. And talk about propagation. If you would take a grain of corn and plant that grain, and then you would take the ears of corn that grew from that one grain, and the following year plant every one of those grains of corn, and then the following year you took all of the grains of corn that grew from those grains of corn that you planted, and you plant them again, in 6 years, you would have enough corn to plant the entire land surface of the earth. Seed yielding herbs after their kind. Trees yielding seeds after their kind. Marvelous, the design, which demonstrates the wisdom of the infinite Creator. I tried. Next Sunday we'll continue in chapter 1. And at this rate... sometime in the middle of the millennium, we will conclude our journey through the Bible. David the psalmist said, "Lord, I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and that my soul knows right well." There have been some very fascinating books written of late by neurologists, Christian neurologists, on the brain, its functions, capacities. And as I've read a lot of these books on the human brain, on the nervous system, on the blood, blood cells, I realize that David's statement was probably one of the greatest understatements. I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and that my soul knows right well. The marvels of creation, they all testify of an infinitely wise God. The design, the whole structure. And of course, we're not going to try to go into these things, but they are a fascinating study that I would encourage you to do some reading on some of the various facets of the human body to realize how marvelously we were created. And yet, God created all of us for a definite purpose of knowing Him and loving Him. And if you don't know God and if you don't love God, then you haven't fulfilled the very purpose of your existence. And your life is a waste. And so I would encourage you, know God. Love God. Find the real purpose for living. May the Lord be with you and bless you. And may you come to know Him a little more this week. May you become a little more keen in your observation of His creation. As you look at those beautiful ranunculus that are now in bloom, the gazanias, the ice plant, All bringing forth seed after its kind, all propagating after itself. All there for a purpose and a plan of the divine creator. Just become a little more aware of him. And stand in awe of his creative genius. That's what worship is all about. Acknowledging God for what he is and what he has done. Don't be like the fool who worships and serves the creation more than the creator. That's irrational, but that is man today. And that's the problem with man. He worships the creature rather than the creation, the creator. He worships the created object rather than the creator. And that's on the road down. And you can read that road down in Romans chapter 1, because he did not want to retain God in his mind. His foolish heart was darkened. And he worshiped the creature more than the creator, who is blessed forevermore. Therefore, God says, all right, that's what you want. I'm let you be a total fool. You can wear the invisible suit, that your folly might be noted even by the most simple person. May you discover God in all of his glory, in all of his power, in all of his love. And may you live that new dimension in the Spirit with him. In Jesus' name.